This is the SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight, I'm torturing Jame, because that's the other thing I like to do, because we're never going to be at a con together, so I don't have to worry about her killing me.
That's what you think, Patrick.
I saw you trying to find minions online on Twitter.
Trying? I already have minions.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
I already have them. I'm Jame Gates. I am an editor, a publicist, an author. I'm currently the communications director for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. Oh. Yeah, I know. Don't get me started. I am also currently working on two anthologies. One is War Stories, which is modern military science fiction. And the other just got off its feet recently, and that is Genius Loci, which is Spirit of Place. And that one I'm in the process of working on.
It's like you don't want to do zombies anymore.
Don't start.
Sarah knows what I'm talking about. So, Jame, tonight we're going to talk about what? Epic fantasy. So you threw it out there that this is grand kingdoms and endless battles, fair maidens and bright queens, elves and lost scions? Is that what you said? Scions? Really? Scions?
No, that's yours. I think I said Cylons in the terms of what I was about to send to your house next time you mentioned zombies.
Gotcha.
The first real fantasy book that I picked up was Tolkien. It appealed to my love of mythology. I saw something that mentioned it, and this was about when the movies came out, and I saw something that mentioned the Finnish mythological aspect of it, and that was what made me interested. And from there, some of the next books I picked up were Laura Resnick and Tad Williams and Kate Elliott. And so this is actually really awesome for me, because these are some of the foundational fantasy authors for me that we're getting to talk to. And then recently found Felix's work as well. And they all have their own flavors, and they're also very much classic epic fantasy. So I kind of want to discuss the different shapes it takes, the way that it's building mythologies for worlds that don't really exist, and the life that some of those worlds take on.
Well, and now that you've dropped all their names, let's start introducing them one at a time.
Yes.
So I have to do this fairly, so give me a second here. Okay, let's see. Laura, you critted. So Laura.
My name is Laura Resnick. I used to write, or I did write an epic fantasy trilogy, the Solarian trilogy, that was about a dozen years ago. The moment I write an urban fantasy series for DAW, the Esther Diamond series. I've written a lot of short stories. I'm a columnist for Novelist Inc. I actually started out as a romance writer years ago, which people tend to refer to as my secret past, because I did it under another name.
And Laura, I have a great Worldcon Hugo ceremony story that I want to tell you at some point, but not right now. Next up, we're going to say hello to Kate Elliott.
Well, I'll say hello. Hi, Kate.
Kate, we lost you.
Oh, my God. She's been swept up in some trans-Pacific incident.
Oh, no.
So while we're waiting for Kate to come back, Tad, why don't you say hello?
Hi, my name's Tad Williams. I write primarily fantasy, although science fiction also. I'm known for the Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn books, the Otherland books, the Shadow March books. More recently, I've been writing what's sometimes called urban fantasy, the Bobby Dollar books. And I'm all over the internet in various places, much to the disgust of most decent people. You can find me on my website, on Twitter, although that's mostly my wonderful wife, Deborah Beal, and also on Facebook.
Yes, isn't she Mrs. Tad or something like that?
I think, in fact, it's kind of a sarcastic name. It's like, if you think this is all I am, ha, 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 kind of a thing. So,
well, and it's funny because I was saying before we started recording that you are the author who actually had me shouting at characters. I was shouting at the characters in Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn, because I felt like they were making such horrible decisions. I didn't even actually at the time think about yelling at you as the author. I was just yelling at the characters. I was like, no, what are you doing? Why are you making these decisions? You're ruining everything.
Well, you probably should have been yelling at me, because I think most of us writers, at least in part, base our characters on our own experience. So when you're talking about characters who make lots of bad decisions, you're usually talking, in my case, about a writer who has made lots of bad decisions.
So let's say hello to Felix Gilman.
Hi, I'm Felix Gilman. I have written 5 books now, which at least 2 were more or less epic fantasy, The Half-Made World and The Rise of Ransom City, which are kind of epic fantasy / western / other things. And most recently I wrote a book called The Revolutions, which is a sort of planetary romance, Victorian science fiction, epic thing. I'm on Twitter at Felix Gilman, and I have a website which I never touch, but I'm on Twitter far too much.
And Felix, weren't you also, were nominated for like a Locus Award and the Campbell Award and stuff too, so even though you're perhaps a bit newer on the scene than most of us, you've made quite a name for yourself already.
Well, thank you.
And Felix,
I'm having trouble with my headphones.
That's okay. And I think I'm catching a bit of an accent. Are you from Kentucky?
No, I'm from London, but I've lived in various parts of the States for 15 years.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. And then we think that possibly Kate is back.
Am I?
Yes, you
Am
are.
I here?
Yes, you are. You exist.
Okay. It's quite amazing to me every time I find that out. Yes, I am Kate Elliott. I've written a lot of epic fantasy because I just can't stop myself. I've written the Geron series, which is science fiction, The Crown of Stars, very long 7-book series, Crossroads trilogy, Spirit Walker trilogy, which is my version of epic fantasy written in first person. And I have a new epic fantasy starting next year and also a YA fantasy coming out next year.
Go ahead. And what's called?
The epic fantasy will be called Black Wolves, and the YA is called Court of Fives.
And just as with Tad, your series, the Crown of Stars, also that I wasn't yelling at the characters, but you did kick me in the gut a couple of times.
Thank you. I really appreciate knowing that, and it makes me happy.
It does.
If my readers cry, I'm happy.
Well, you definitely kicked me a couple of times there. So I think it started along the like Prince of Dogs is when it, the first yeah. one, and then somewhere around the Gathering Storm, I think I got kicked again.
Thank you.
Those of us who like to injure readers know that's why writing is so satisfying, because you can kick so many people compared to if you had to go to all their houses.
And you don't even hurt your toes.
No, good point.
Now, the last of our panel is Sarah Chorn, who is a SF Signal irregular, and she writes the special needs and you say it, Sarah. It's better.
All right.
Strange needs, special fiction. Special fiction, strange needs. I always mix them up.
Keep trying, dude. I'm Sarah Chorn, and I run the review website Bookworm Blues, and I do special needs and strange worlds on SF Signal. And I've started kind of bothering the people at Ragnarok Publications, and they have felt sorry for me, and so they're letting me help with their publicity. And that's it. I'm on Twitter a lot as Bookworm Blues, and Facebook as Bookworm Blues, and everywhere as Bookworm Blues. So that's me.
And Sarah reads a billion books a year. It's insane.
I read an entire rainforest of books a year. I am ruining the environment.
Bless you.
Single-handedly.
We've got too much darn environment anyway.
And exactly. Yes. Who needs to breathe?
And I did, there was, you had a Facebook post that absolutely cracked me up, Sarah, because someone asked if you would review their novel, Novelle.
Yeah. Yeah, I got some good email. Yeah.
Yikes.
That's a good one too, compared to a lot of them. But anyway.
Hector, no, I'm sorry. I recently adopted 3 cats, and they're all in the room right now.
Oh boy,
up to mischief.
Yeah, they're yeah. You have to sleep with one eye open now. So we have a great crew here, Jane. What's first on the agenda?
So Kate actually touched on the first question a little bit earlier, but obviously right now TV is starting to really see all of the good options that fantasy and science fiction offer for its various channels and money-making efforts. And there are a lot of people saying, oh, look, George R. R. Martin changed the world of fantasy. He's, you know, reinvented it. And you know, from outside the genre, it may look like that because you haven't seen it before. But for those of us in it, I mean, from Tolkien on, and even before Tolkien, there are so many big fantasies, you know, in and out of mythology. And there have all, for the last, how many years has it been since Tolkien? Because I just completely
lost track of what year it is.
Tolkien died in 73, but The Lord of the Rings was started coming out in the late 1950s.
Okay, so, you know, it's been 60 plus years, and you know, there's so much epic fantasy and so much of it that has changed people's lives and changed the genre one bit at a time. So I just kind of want to talk about some of the books and authors that you guys think started the genre and continued it after Tolkien, and then the renovation or the renewal of interest when the movies, the Tolkien movies came out, and what has been published recently that you think is moving the genre forward outside of just George R. R. Martin.
So let's start with Kate, because Kate had some interesting words that she wanted to share with people.
Let's see if I can reproduce them. I could actually go back.
It's going to be embarrassing no matter what you say, so just take a shot.
I could go back farther than Tolkien, but I won't for the moment for the sake of brevity. Tolkien, of course, was the big influence on American science fiction. And I think that the first person who really made a concerted effort and in an extremely popular way to kind of talk back to Tolkien was Tad Williams in the Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn trilogy. He's the first one who said, "This was such an influential work, now I want to examine it." And we do talk a lot about Game of Thrones, and you know, George Martin's a fabulous, fabulous writer as changing the genre, and there are things, important things that he did, but I really look earlier than that to see that big shift happening.
And I will say this, the progression for me was I actually read the Chronicles of Narnia first, and then I read The Hobbit, and then my seventh grade teacher said, "Well, if you've read The Hobbit and you like it, you should read The Lord of the Rings." Gave me that. And then I didn't read any more fantasy until 2000. At which point I started consuming it, and I read Robert Jordan, and I read Tad Williams, and I read C.J. Shara, and I read Kate Elliott, and I read Ellie Modisett Jr., and all these other books, Terry Brooks and Terry Goodkind and all this stuff, and then I read George R. R. Martin. So I was already being influenced by Tad well before George R. R. Martin. So Tad, what about you? I mean, what was the thinking? I mean, where did you come from? Were you looking to change the genre? Were you just thinking, "Hey, I got this great story I want to get out, and oh gosh, I want to make my publisher split it into two books"?
Kate's very kind words aside, I mean, there was a very vibrant, healthy, epic fantasy subgenre going on by the time I came along. And you know, you mentioned people like Terry Brooks and others. There were a lot of people were writing books that were responsive to Tolkien, that were many times were cases where people wanted that feeling of the epic fantasy that and the depth and all that stuff. The only thing that I think I might have brought to it a little bit was that I was very, very much interested in how Tolkien affected people and how other people tried to replicate that without, I felt, necessarily understanding it. And a conversation about, you know, what I set out to do and what I did is probably way beyond the scope of what we're doing here, because nobody else will get to talk. So I just wanted to say that, you know, there were a lot of good people working at the same time. Haven't mentioned Guy Kay, but Guy Gabriel Kay does wonderful work. I was influenced also by earlier writers like Ursula Le Guin and Fritz Leiber and a lot of others. But what I think I was trying to do, and what I think maybe more people are trying to do now, was to actually have a, God dare I say it, a metafictional level to the book, which was about the ideas and about the tropes that Tolkien had brought to bear and that I thought were being kind of absorbed and then regurgitated without people really thinking about them much.
So when you look at it, if you look at Tolkien stuff and then you look at a lot of the epic fantasy out there, if you go to Terry Brooks, I think it's very very, very similar. If you want identical, you go to Denis L. McKiernan, because his intention was always to write a sequel to The Lord of the Rings. The publishers, or the family, said no. The publisher said, we want to publish it anyway. Change it slightly. He did that. Boom, Mythgar was born.
Well, one last thing I'll say, which is that I think we always have a bit of a problem when we're talking about epic fantasy, because and a lot of times epic fantasy, even within our own field, gets very heavily criticized. And I think sometimes people misunderstand, and they conflate two things, which is epic fantasy as a literary subgenre and epic fantasy as a commercial market. And because it became such a huge commercial market after Tolkien, it drew in a lot of writers and readers who just wanted to reproduce that experience. But as far as the people writing in it, all the way from the people on this panel here to people like Gene Wolfe and others, there's been a lot of people who have tried to do new and interesting things with it that we don't always get credit for. And now I'll shut up for a while.
No, you're fine. Felix, what I'm curious is, James' original question is kind of, you know, what was out there influencing things before Jar Jar or Martin, in your opinion?
For me, I think it was probably Michael Moorcock.
Michael Moorcock?
Michael Moorcock. This is probably a transatlantic difference, but growing up in the UK, I read Tolkien. I remember reading Tolkien. I remember reading Terry Brooks. I remember writing what probably would nowadays be called Terry Brooks fan fiction when I was about 10. I have a vivid memory of writing that in school notebooks, a very, very long, essentially Terry Brooks thing, possibly even before I ever read Tolkien. But for me, my sense of modern contemporary fantasy would have come from reading Michael Moorcock when I was 12 years old and you know, still reading him today. Which is strange when you think about the timing of it, because as we were just saying, Tolkien was writing in the 50s, Michael Moorcock was writing in the 60s, but there seems to be a huge difference of time between these two things. And one of them feels very contemporary and one of them doesn't.
And in fact, Felix, as you probably know, Michael does not like The Lord of the Rings very much at all.
I know he is not very much, which I for all that I like Michael Moorcock's work, I mean, I disagree. I like The Lord of the Rings a lot, but you know, I know a lot of people don't like it, and I completely understand why they don't like it.
It's very much a class thing with him.
Yes. Yeah, and he's right. He's completely right that Tolkien is conservative and sentimental and aggressive in a lot of ways, but you know, I nevertheless find the sentimental romantic side of Tolkien very moving. I mean, I get weepy when the elves sail off into the west. So,
okay. And Sarah, what about you?
Oh, let's see. I read Tolkien back when I was in junior high, and then the next thing I went to right away was Dragonlance and the books about Raistlin and all those people. And then after that, it was Tad Williams and Robert Jordan and Marion Zimmer Bradley and other books like that. And then I started really branching out. But in my mind, when I think about epic fantasy, for me, kind of the bridge between Tolkien and then all the other ones was Dragonlance. It was the epic quest and adventure and the group of people going out and doing things and the good and the bad and everything else. And then the games that you play and all that stuff was, for me, what got my feet wet.
Like the Dragons of Winter, whatever, and the Dragons of Summer, and those Dragonlance books or ones before those?
I'm trying to think.
I think those are the first ones, aren't they?
The Margaret Weiss books?
Yeah, those. Okay. Yeah, so that was what did it for me. And to touch on the George R. R. Martin point, to kind of bring it all back, I'm not going to go on a rant, don't worry. I'm just going to say, I think instead of really kind of transforming epic fantasy, I think what he's done as an author is to tell other authors that it's okay to write about people being eviscerated. It's all right for the gore and the darkness, because until I read him, I never really experienced an author writing about someone being killed because they're being hung from a castle by their intestines. That just never happened. So I think he kind of pioneered grimdark in my mind. Maybe I'm wrong, but anyway.
Well, here's the thing. I've been to plenty of world cons. I've been invited to different events and parties and stuff like that. I always accept. The only thing I will ever pass on, should it ever happen, would be if George Martin actually did invite me to a wedding. Laura.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, I tried to read Tolkien when I was in my early 20s and much easier to please than I am now, and I found him absolutely unreadable. Couldn't get more than a few chapters. People who know me have found this out and said, "Oh my God, we can't be friends. Leave my house now, you cur." So if you want me to leave the program,
we love you anyways. It's okay.
Thank you. So it wasn't for me, and I also tried to sit through the first film, and it's one of the very, very few times I've ever fallen asleep in the cinema. So clearly Tolkien doesn't speak to me. I do know the story, however, because BBC did a radio play, and when I was traveling in Africa, I was living rough in the Congo, crossing through the bush, and somebody was playing this BBC radio play episode by episode at night after we would camp. And in the Congo, after dark falls, there's really nothing else to do. So I sat through the whole radio play, still didn't like it. So that said, I think Tolkien presumably influenced all of us simply by influencing the genre so much. It would sort of be like saying, you know, you play pop music without being influenced by Elvis or the Beatles. Just because they were such huge influences on your whole field, there's got to be some influence on you, even if it's not a direct one. It can kind of ricochet off of other things and reach you. So there's probably some sense in which this writer, who I find completely unreadable, even influenced me. But I'm not that genre focused. When I think of fantasy, I think of it as the oldest and most universal form of fiction. I think of, you know, the Bible, Genesis, gods and supernatural events and prophets and people who lived for hundreds of years and founded tribes. And these tribes went to war and good triumphed over evil, or evil triumphed over good, and people started worshiping others, gods, because one was more powerful than the other. And I think of the Iliad, which, you know, really in 1200 BC, the sacking of Troy was probably all about gold and trade routes. But we have this tremendous story about it, in which it is all about, you know, the quest for this woman who's either run off or been abducted, depending on which version you listen to or read. And, you know, tremendous heroes like Achilles, who's sulking in his tent, and Hector, who's been saddled with this terrible situation and is trying to make the best of it, and Paris, who's an idiot, and Ajax, who's this, you know, larger than life figure. And this is what you remember. You're not transfixed by the idea of you know, a battle for a city that was on the Dardanelles and had a lot of money. You're transfixed by these characters in this world full of gods and magic and good and evil and heroic tasks and the human heart in conflict with itself. So I really always think of the roots as fantasy as going back there, and that's what I believe we're still doing, and it's the kind of thing I'm thinking about when I'm writing. Whether it's, you know, a big epic trilogy like the Silmarillion trilogy, which did have warriors and gods and the fate of societies and so on, or the series I write now, which is urban fantasy, which is comedy and set in contemporary New York City, I always think of those things. The Arthurian tales also, you know, there's a wizard, there's this tragic love triangle, there's an attempt to change and enlighten a society. It all goes bad. But those are what I think of as the roots and ways in which we're still echoing back to that sound.
So what, as far as what we would consider to be epic fantasy, though, who was the first epic fantasy author that did speak to you, Laura?
I suppose it would be T.H. White, the Once and Future King.
Okay.
definitely an epic book. It took me almost a year to read it. and did cover, you know, those themes. And of course, it's, you know, it's kind of the, one of the great modern novels of the Camelot stories. And I think that was it. And that, of course, kind of got me very interested in the whole Arthurian thing, which I think also when I was young, and I think it especially appeals to young people because it is in large part about the tragedy of idealism, which by the time you're the age I am now, you think, well, yeah, that's going to go badly. But at 20, you really want it to work. And so then I read Mary Stuart's Merlin trilogy, and that's always stayed with me. That's been one of the most, I think, powerful things to me. And again, it's about characters. I wasn't really riveted by the whole idea of attempting to form a representative partial democracy in the Dark Ages. I was really riveted by these characters who loved and hated and tried and made mistakes and tried to figure out how can I make it right now that I've made this mistake. And I think that is what we always harken back to, these people dealing with these larger than life problems in this very human way.
Which brings us to Tail Chaser's song.
It does.
No, I'm just no. which actually was gifted to me a couple of years ago from somebody after I wrote Conversations with My Cat. I don't know why they made that connection, but they did. James,
could be the cat thing.
It
Patrick.
Could be, yes. James,
you know, on the subject of Tail Chaser's song, though, I have to say that that had one of the scenes that genuinely creeped me out. I mean, I can read straight horror books without getting really all that much from it, but the scene where the matriarch is in her den, yeah, that, I don't know why, but that really, really got under my skin. So congratulations. That doesn't happen very often.
Well, thank you very much. Like Alice, it's always gratifying to know we've kicked somebody in the stomach.
I'll remember that, Tad.
And you got to remember, this is James, and there were authors out there who their specific purpose with a specific anthology was to gross her out and freak her out and make her go, ugh. And that was their purpose, and none of them managed to do it. So.
I'm glad to know it.
Good job.
Just because Patrick insists on bringing it up, for those of you who don't know, I've edited an anthology of zombie erotica.
Oh, my God.
Not intentionally.
Oh, my God.
I now hate zombies with a passion.
And the title was Rigor Amortis.
Rigor
Amortis? This is what
happens
when I make jokes.
Rigor Amortis.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
I literally made a joke on Twitter, and it blew up like an over... baked corpse.
Yeah.
In my face.
And authors just started sending her stories to try to gross her out.
That's lovely.
It lends a whole new meaning to the term slush pile.
And you know what though? God. You know what though, James? The good part of that story is that not only did they send you found a publisher.
I didn't find a publisher. A publisher found me.
Either way, it's still amazing.
But anyways, so. And one of the things that keeps getting brought up is pre-Tolkien fantasy. So what are some of the works that actually that founded the genre in its current-ish incarnation? You know, what are those stories that influenced Tolkien that influenced the people who read him, the publishers who bought his books? Basically, what paved the way for Lord of the Rings?
Let's start with you, Felix.
I'm actually right now in the middle of reading The Worm or the Boris, if anyone else has read that.
I have read it. I read it when I was a teenager. Yeah.
So I didn't actually catch the name, Felix. What was it?
The Worm or the Boris?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I've had it on my shelves for a very long time. Never got around to reading it. Picked it up.
Brilliant.
Yes, it's very, very, very odd. It's almost some outsider art, but fascinating. Well,
one of the things about that and a lot, just I'll say something really quickly, which is Tolkien what his main influence was is he took epic fantasy, which had largely been the preserve of sort of eccentric Victorian and Edwardians, and all of a sudden made it into a commercial genre because people like E.R. Edison, who wrote that, and William Morris and Lord Dunsany and all the sort of classics.
And don't forget Mervyn Peake, Ted, Gormenghast trilogy.
That was already, wasn't that mentioned? I was going to mention that, and T.H. White, which are all favorites of mine, but these were all kind of eccentric, strange little side projects that, you know, and what Tolkien's success did was all of a sudden it said, oh, there's an audience for eccentric little projects like this.
Right. I mean, very much against Tolkien's, I wouldn't say against his will, though my sense is always that he was sort of surprised and appalled.
Yeah, I think he was delighted by the money, but kind of horrified to find out who his readers now were.
There was there was something on IO9 or Tor.com or something like that. It was a link to a series of letters or something that he had corresponded with someone. Anyway, he had come to a Tolkien Society event, and it was one of the few times that he was absolutely pleased with his fans because they had set up a very hobbit-like dinner, and there was all this fresh tobacco and for him to smoke in his pipe and all this kind of stuff. That kind of stuff made him happy. But yeah, I think the commercialize and the success and everything, that kind of freaked him out.
Well, if you read the Humphrey Carpenter book of collected letters, you'll see that he was also like getting phone calls from stoned American teenagers at like, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, going like, "Hey, man, you wrote that Frodo thing, dude." You know, and I mean, this is a 75-year-old English don. You know, this was not really his kind of, you know, his kind of party, I think.
Yeah, wasn't it? They said in the 70s that graffiti started showing up in the subways of New York that said Frodo lives.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, Felix, continue.
Where was I? What were we talking about?
You were talking about the book.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
People that influenced the genre.
People that influenced the genre. Well, I don't know. Beyond talking, you mentioned Mervyn Peake, or I think Kate mentioned Mervyn Peake. I mean, I think of Mervyn Peake as absolutely central to a certain kind of fantasy, a certain sort of, the kind of fantasy that now gets called New Weird, or got called New Weird 10 years ago before people stopped calling stuff that. But that I think of as
sure.
Central to a particular niche part of the genre. I don't know to what extent
he was one
right prior to Tolkien.
They were to around, the peak. Yeah, he was publishing and writing in the 40s primarily, I think.
Yeah, it came out it came out before and then after World War, I can't remember, to be honest.
That sounds roughly correct.
That sounds roughly right. But I don't know to what extent he influenced Tolkien. And as I say, I mean, I think his influence, I mean, he clearly influenced people like M. John Harrison, and I know Michael Moorcock used to go to Mervyn Peake's parties in London in the 60s, and you know, that strain of influence, but I don't know how much that affects the genre as a whole. But yes, I mean, the Worm of Boris is a fascinating example of pre-Tolkien. It's a clearly an Edwardian gentleman's passionate project. As you were saying, it's something produced out of an amateur love of Icelandic fables. It reads, it's fascinating and powerful and clearly an intensely original work that reads as though it wasn't really written for anyone else to read. He was playing around with his love of Icelandic stories, and it doesn't read like fiction as such. It's much, much rougher edged than Tolkien. And Tolkien today feels sort of rough edged in a lot of ways, but he's a much smoother and more, you can see why Tolkien had massive commercial success and didn't.
Sure.
If I could give a shout out to somebody else, and I'm pretty sure that Kate will agree with me on this one, and perhaps others will as well. But one of the people that really wound up influencing a lot of my generation of writers was Lynn Carter, the editor, who was not a particularly great writer himself, but he was a very, very fine editor when it came to tracking things down and exposing them to new generations. And in the wake of Tolkien's success, he actually went out and put together editions of, I don't know if he did Edison or Peake, but he certainly did Dunsany and William Morris and James Branch Cable and the guy who wrote Fantasties, MacDonald, and a bunch of other people like that who were, in fact, just what we're talking about. They were the precursors to Tolkien, in some cases working some of the same territories. So if you go out and look, those who are actually interested in this stuff, if you go out and look for those Lynn Carter, I think they were Ballantine collections from the 60s and early 70s. There's some wonderful stuff that you probably won't ever find out about otherwise. That is and in this. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, he also wrote a book like that was on writing fantasy. Did he not?
Well,
like
he wrote
an essay collection or something.
Yeah, he wrote a couple things like that. He actually wrote an entire book about where Tolkien got his influences from in an age when very few people knew much about Tolkien in America. And I think he wrote some others like the one that you're talking about, Kate. So I'm sure that there's just a several things like that. He was really a popularizer and one of the very best.
So, Kate, would you agree with all that, or do you want to completely disagree with Tad?
No, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that in this situation, I agree with him. But what's interesting? Sorry. But what's interesting to me is when I look at people reading epic fantasy now, I think that a lot of them haven't read and maybe see no reason to read Tolkien or any of his precursors. So it's interesting to see how that formation moves, because he was influenced by these things, we were influenced by these things, and then you've got a new generation coming in and writing who are influenced by the things that have happened before without necessarily being directly influenced by them from having read them themselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's how the whole thing changes. We see a lot more world influences now, people talking as Laura quite rightly did about the place of ancient epics and the old epic, which would be the Iliad and the Odyssey, but also ones from other places in the world, not just the Western world.
Good point.
So I'm trying to remember, is it Lawhead? Stephen R. Lawhead is doing some things that are, they feel fantasy-ish, but they're kind of different.
No, I haven't read him.
I don't know Lawhead as well.
Sarah, am I wrong?
Well, I haven't read a ton of his stuff, but he has recently, within the past few years, finished a series which was a retelling of Robin Hood. So from what I gather from him, I think he merges historical fiction and yeah, kind of dips a toe into fantasy a little bit.
Because he also did the Pendragon Cycle, I think is what it was called. And there was like Taelsian or something like that was Merlin. And there was
Taliesin.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll never pronounce anything correctly, Ted.
That's what you have me for.
Well, the Arthurian, it's interesting too, because the Arthurian saga certainly gets folded into epic fantasy. And, you know, we were mentioning, Laura, I think, mentioned first T.H. White and The Once and Future King, which was huge for me and a lot of other people too. But it's almost a separate thing in a sense. It's kind of odd. You know, there's Arthurian stuff kind of has its own area, and there's a lot of people who've read Arthurian stuff like Mary Stuart and things like that who never read any other fantasy.
What about Beowulf?
Well, yeah, but that's a little different. I mean, when you're reading Beowulf, you're reading, you know, something that was written, you know, 1500 years ago or more.
But there's new translations all the time. So like the Seamus Heaney translation was very popular and brought a lot of people into it that might not have read it before.
Absolutely. But I'm saying that even fairly contemporary Arthurian stuff, a lot of times there's not a huge overlap with. I don't get many people who say, oh, I read a lot of Arthurian stuff, plus I read all this epic fantasy. I mean, it does happen, obviously, but it doesn't seem to be an automatic connection. I don't know why, and I don't think anybody cares, but I just thought I'd throw that out.
Well, I think it's one of those things, Arthurian stuff, Robin Hood, Arabian Nights, there's certain things that are really mainstream tropes or themes. Everyone has heard of these things. So even if they pick up one of these novels and it has magical elements and things we think of as fantasy, they're seeing it as kind of a historical novel with, you know, these very, very old conventions in it. I don't think they're thinking of it as a fantasy novel. A fantasy novel is that section of the bookstore where those weird geeks hang out, and
right,
the titles are hard to pronounce, and when you open them, there are, you have to like learn all this world building. And I think they're just not interested. I think they're looking at it as a mainstream novel that has maybe a little magic realism in it. So I think a lot of fantasy readers also read Robin Hood and Arthurian fiction and so on. But I think there are a lot of people who read those very well-known,
right,
Archetypal stories who have no interest in fantasy as a genre.
Well, and interestingly, I actually, before I read Tolkien, Sir Walter Scott was one of my favorite authors. I absolutely, Ivanhoe is a book that I've read, I read so many times. Ben-Hur, a lot of these gigantic classic novels that have a lot of mythological or fantastic elements in them, but there's no way that they count in most people's minds, even mine, honestly, as fantasy. So that's a really good point.
Well, it's also
a matter of genre classification, because
yes,
when you say, you know, what would be my all-time favorite fantasy novel, I would probably say The Eighth by Catherine Neville, but it's actually sold as a thriller. So, you know, is it not fantasy just because it's shelved elsewhere, or is it fantasy just because I say so? It's a pretty fluid description.
That's a completely different rabbit hole, though, because we can talk about how Anne Rice is literature and not, you know, vampire porn. But
Margaret Atwood, I think she's a great example of the genre wars and classification.
See, that's why I like Angry Robot, because on the back of the book they have suggestion
yeah,
categories. But to Laura's point earlier, you know, one of the earliest things I was handed, probably in the fourth grade or fifth grade, was Bullfinch's Mythology.
As should every child be handed mythology, and not just Western mythology, but other kinds of mythology as well.
Sure. And
you know, I went to a tiny private Christian school, and there was a book on Native American mythology. I don't know how it got there. It was it was kids' tales of Native American mythology. But that right there was that book that completely got me looking outside of typical European-based mythology, and it was huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and we can't discount Darby O'Gill and the Little People. So,
well, actually, we can, Patrick. We can. And we have already.
Darby O'Gill and the Little People. Sarah, you haven't said much on this subject.
I don't really have a ton to say.
What do you think about Darby O'Gill, Sarah? Honestly, give us the straight.
Honestly, I have no idea what the hell you're talking about. So, how's that?
That's even better.
I don't really have a ton to say on this topic, because I'm like Laura Resnick. I read The Lord of the Rings, and I hated every second of it. I'm sorry, but it's
high
true.
Five.
I just couldn't do it. I did it for homework, but I really am not that educated in the stuff that came around then or before. For me, what has seemed to influence fantasy, and maybe it's just a progression of how I got into the genre, but it's been world mythology. Because, I mean, where would we be without the Greek and Roman gods? I mean, really, those are some of the weirdest stories I've ever heard. What gets more fantasy than that? So for me, the early stuff has been the mythology. But that's also what I read first. I was way into Arthurian tales. And that's what kind of got my brothers to say, if you like that, why don't you try this stuff? So I don't know. I have nothing.
What I want to know is why hasn't more stuff been influenced by the Silmarillion? So,
because it's very dry.
Oh my God, it is.
I mean,
I love the Silmarillion so much.
I did too.
That's the one I struggle to get through.
Well, but the thing is what the Silmarillion was, for those of you out there who don't know, the Silmarillion is Tolkien's follow-up, and it's basically his cataloging all the mythology and all the history of everything leading up to the Lord of the Rings. And let's face it, it's like Laura struggling to even be able to listen to the radio production of The Lord of the Rings in the back of beyond somewhere in the middle of the night with nothing else to do. Obviously, if it's that much of a struggle for her even to be able to listen to it, she's not going to go running back and going, but I'll bet the Silmarillion will really work for me. You know, I mean, the Silmarillion was, you know, it was like liner notes off, you know, off of old Rolling Stones records or something. You know, it was for the serious Konyo Shenti. So,
I have a theory about this, which is that epic fantasy is, if we're looking at it from the Tolkien-esque tradition, is that balance between the world building, and of course, because he was an etymologist, it was the linguistic world building in his world is just amazing.
Yeah.
And then what Laura points out, which is our desire as human beings to connect with the stories of characters and their emotional journeys. And epic fantasy kind of becomes this balance. And if the world building becomes too heavy, then most people will bog down. And if the character becomes too heavy, then it's not that the characterization can be too heavy, in my opinion, but then it becomes less, then it's not maybe epic in the same way, then it becomes something else equally good, just not epic. So does that make sense? So
absolutely.
We're always balancing character and world.
So hold on. So I'm gonna hijack this for a minute here, James. So for the last 47 roughly minutes, J.R.R. Tolkien has dominated this entire conversation. When you talk about the balance between character and this and that, you know, Tolkien wrote The Hobbit, and then he wrote The Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings was intended to be one book. The publisher split it into two. Tad can relate.
So can I.
Yes. So how do we get from, you know, that being, you know, three books can being considered, you know, this epic fantasy to, you know, Robert Jordan doing 15 and Kate described her own Crown of Stars as 7 as being, you know, massive. And Tad's first fantasy series, that the Song of Memory and Thorn was very dense, you know, and then you got George R. R. Martin. How do we go from, I mean, how is the balance working today, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
I have something to say, but I've been talking a lot. I'll wait.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say the word processor, but that's a flippant.
Well, there's There's also, I don't think epic is defined by how many books are in your series. I think it's defined by what is the size of your story, the scope. The canvas or the tapestry that you're on. But there's also a question of market forces. I mean, in Robert Jordan's case, they kept writing the books after the guy was dead, for God's sake. So, you know, they wouldn't have done that if there wasn't a question of market forces at work. Publishing is a much more numbers-driven business now than it was, you know, 60 years ago when Tolkien was writing. If he were writing now and had the success now that he had then, the comparative success, he'd be getting pressure to do a fourth and a fifth and a sixth book. And, you know, he'd probably be willing to. We tell these stories because we like to.
That's a short story idea right there, Tolkien getting pressured. What I would like to add one thing to it, which is I think one of the key elements that separates what we call epic fantasy from other kinds of fantasy, and this is both in the genre sense and the commercial market sense, is the immersiveness of the experience. Epic fantasy readers tend to want to be immersed, and they want the background, and they want the feeling that that is a very complicated world that is there all the time, and the story is just taking you there. Whereas that is not necessarily always one of the prime experiences of other kinds of literature. So
well,
that would be my...
And Felix, you just launched, is it the Revolutions?
Yeah.
And that's going to be, what, book one of 27?
Yes and no.
It was
sold as a standalone, and then I immediately started thinking about ways in which I could characters in it go to something that is kind of like a Victorian vision of Mars, and I immediately started thinking, what if I did one where they go to the moon, and then one where they go to Mercury, and then I could have 7 books or more, and then I realized that would never happen. But yes, I mean, I immediately started thinking, what if I turn this into a gigantic series? Why not? And then I realized that I hate writing books too. So then I thought,
Amen. It does not everybody, Felix. I'm glad to hear you say that. I love having written, but writing is like poking knitting needles in my eyes. I don't know.
Thank you. I hate people who go, oh, I just love writing. I can't wait to sit down and write.
What a great job you have.
Particularly book two.
Oh my God.
It's the follow up book, which is.
I think we just crushed a lot of people's dreams.
I think
it's going to be like, no.
I think you just crushed Sarah. I mean, Sarah.
I would love being a writer if someone else would just do the writing for me.
Exactly. And here we all are in the same dilemma. So there's none of us are going to take over for any of the others. So we can just skip that whole part right now.
Yeah, I just had an author reach out to me on Facebook and ask me about recording software and handheld recording devices and stuff, because he wants to start just dictating his stories. And I said, yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Have you, Kate, I thought you did that at one point, or you were thinking about
it. At one point I had to, but I did it for because of tendonitis.
Right.
But I did it only for as long as I had to, and then I stopped. I just couldn't. I processed through my hands for some reason. So
I think that's probably true for most of us. Yeah.
Well, and Kevin J. Anderson lives here. He lives in Colorado Springs, and he does that. He actually does dictate. He'll go on walks in the mountains, and then he has someone who transcribes for him. And I've taken walks in the mountains here in Colorado, and I just don't understand. I mean, it's got to be a pain in the ass to get out all the panting, you know, the as you're trying to talk and walk at the same time. So yeah, it's a completely different process.
At least he says that's what he's doing.
Yeah, it's a completely different process. I don't get it. What's James? What's the next question?
So we've talked about Tolkien and influences and so on and so forth, but with fantasy hitting the market again and getting more popular, who are some of the authors who maybe aren't writing the 6 foot thick, George R. R. Martin size series, or who are doing things that haven't really been seen a lot recently? One of my favorites right now is N.K. Jemisin's series.
I love that. Yeah,
both of them, they're absolutely amazing, and I want more from them. Felix's Western Victorian fantasy epic stuff, mixing it up and getting it out of the traditional idea of epic fantasy, which is, Tolkien with other things added. So who are some of the new upcoming authors you're really enjoying or looking at?
And Sarah, I'm going to tap you first.
Yes. I look for non-Western because I kind of get sick of that a lot. I like to read it, but it's good to diversify. So the two that I would pick on would be Steven Erikson's Malazan books, which are completely something else.
Yeah.
And they're incredible. And Elizabeth Baer is doing some phenomenal things. Her books are not thick. Her last one was a trilogy. None of the books were huge. They didn't break my door when the UPS guy delivered them. They're just there, but they're totally epic. They're absolutely unique. They're completely non-Western. Nothing I've ever seen before. Fantastic. And I would have to say our darling Felix's Half-Made World books are fantastic too. Epic, sprawling, absolutely unique, completely different, wonderful.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Can I put in a shout out for Cameron Hurley's new?
Yes,
because she's deliberately kind of saying, okay, I'm now going to punch epic fantasy's tropes in the face with the Mirror Empire, which is coming out this month.
And she does it in such a good way. She handles her topics very well.
What about Saladin Ahmed?
Yes.
If we could just get him to write another book.
He just probably found out that he hates writing too.
But he's such a bitch when that happens.
You know what? I'm gonna give him. He gets to slide because he's had a lot of shit going on in his life.
Yeah, I know. He's working hard.
Yes, he is. Felix, what about you?
I'll second Cameron Hurley. I always find myself recommending Steph Swainston's Castle books, which is a fantastic series. There's four of them now. It's sort of epic fantasy comedy of manners It's a very, 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 very strange, new, weird epic, but it's a wonderful series. I recently read Kit Manley's City of Roses, which is a sort of urban fantasy, hipster fairies in Portland epic, and that it's infinitely better than it sounds. It's a fantastic book.
Very cool. I'll also throw out there Helen Lowe. I like her stuff that she's been doing. Kate?
Oh, I did Cameron Hurley. I would just actually mostly follow up with what other people have said. I think we're going to see more and more different epic fantasy coming out, maybe not in the bestsellers right now. The best-selling fantasy still seems to kind of be mired in the same kind of status quo setting, but I think we're seeing more and more people who, like Laura and Sarah, either haven't read Tolkien or don't feel they're influenced by him, and that is going to change how epic fantasy looks in the coming decade.
Oh my God, you are so right. And you know what else that we haven't even touched on that is going to be a huge influence on the next generation of writers and what people think? Well, no, as I was going to say, is children's and YA publishing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes. Oh, my God, yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, if you look at all the people who have, you know, grown up, my kids my own age, the age of my kids, you know, who've grown up reading Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, I mean, all of this quite clever, interesting, you know, there's a huge amount of creative energy that's gone into books for young people, just as stuff flowed into fantasy in the wake of Tolkien, that flowed into YA writing in the wake of Harry Potter. And for a lot of people now, that is where they begin. And also
anime and manga too.
Yes,
you see those, and like, well, just to mention Miyazaki,
yes.
I think that so many people and comics.
Yes.
So we're just a huge, just like, and games. Wait a minute, games.
Oh yeah,
Skyrim.
Yeah.
Dragon Age, Mass Effect.
So that was actually going to be one of my questions in a few minutes. Some of the game companies, the RPG companies, are starting to source some pretty solid fiction lines. I worked for Paizo for a while, and the first book I worked on there actually hit the Locus bestseller list from Dave Gross. And it's solid, funny, well-built fantasy. James Sutter's books for Paizo. They are some of the best fantasy that I've read.
Randy Wagner, all these great young authors are coming up and writing for Paizo. And I just want to throw it out there that I taught Dave Gross how to use Scrivener. So there.
I wanted to say, I think another way in which fantasy and epic fantasy is going to change tremendously is due to self-publishing. For example, when I was writing these, you know, great big fat Solarian trilogy novels like a dozen years ago, the way I got into it was my agent at the time said, I showed him something. He said, well, it's a good story, but I can't sell it. You really need a book of 250,000 words. Then we can sell it. And that was sort of, you know, so I came up with something like that, and how I got into that market. It was a tough length for me. And so I wanted to sell a second series, kind of a spin-off series that would be supposedly short books of a mere 100,000 words. And nobody would touch it because those were too short. And that's just one example of ways in which these very, very market-driven ideas publishers have about what fantasy should be or what they want to publish really influenced a lot of what you were able to read until quite recently, when now you can self-publish anything you want to write, and it no longer has to answer the question, where will we shelve this, which has always been a very common question. Where will we shelve this? How will we categorize this? Those things. So I think there'll be a lot of things coming in fantasy now that there are writers who don't have to deal with a corporate marketing department to get published.
Well, and an example of an author who's doing that is Michael Sullivan. His last book, The Hollow World, was kind of self-published, kind of not self-published, and it's huge. I see it in Barnes & Noble, but he is an example of an author who kind of took control of his own publishing and said, I'm going to do it my way, not your way anymore, and he's a success, and he's kind of blazing the trail for people who are sick of the corporate way of doing things. So,
or even who, if they have a good corporate relationship, there are still other things they want to do that don't fit that model, because there has to be a certain an appeasement of a marketing department who said, we have to know how to sell this. And that can be limiting. And it doesn't mean a limitation of quality, but necessarily a limitation of the variety you can see, which I think those boundaries are being removed.
There's always in publishing of any kind, or in fact, any distribution of commercial art, there's increasing move towards narrow casting everything. Mm. Everybody is trying to eliminate people having to think. You know, they just want essentially intravenous entertainment that you already know what the dosage is, and just to feed it directly, which is why we've had so many sub genres spring up, because there's a great deal of pressure to deliver something that is not going to force somebody out of their comfort zone at all. And I'm hoping that's one of the things I worry about with bookstores disappearing, is that people are going to find it very, very difficult to find anything other than the things that they already read.
Well, now, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Tad, because you did the epic fantasy. You've done a lot of different things. And the I believe the Dirty Streets of Heaven is like urban fantasy with angels.
Yeah.
Which is tons of fun, recently read it.
I believe Sarah loved it, too, unless I'm putting her on the spot and she didn't.
No, I loved it. I love those books.
Sarah said some very nice things.
So what was the decision to make? I mean, was there a decision to make writing that? Was it commercial? Was it just that you had the story to tell? Was it that the marketing department was saying, hey, we need some urban fantasy from you?
Oh, things for me, and I suspect for most of us, things for me always originate in a story I want to tell. Then they all bubble around for a while. But I've always been that way. And I think that probably, again, all of us here have. And there's probably that almost every single writer here, Felix, I don't know well enough to say this for, but I think most of us here could say that if we had found one thing that people liked and just kept writing it over and over and over again, we'd probably be more commercially successful today. Because that is, in fact, when you mentioned Robert Jordan or whatever, he became a brand. And whereas I think I just have to write whatever story is going to excite me, because I have this superstition that if I write something just to be writing it, just to make money, that the readers will notice that. And so I have to be excited, and I'm always being excited by new kinds of ideas.
Well, is that a fantasy thing, though? I mean, because as far as talking about the branding, you've got James Patterson and Tom Clancy are now brands, and other people are writing books for them.
That's not just a brand. That's actually what I would call sharecropping.
I want to agree with what Tad says, actually. My interest, I've written pretty much everything in series, but each series has been pretty different in tone and content from the other one. And for me, that's the interest in it. It's like, okay, I did this thing. I wrote a Grimm trilogy with Crossroads, and now I want to write something that's more of a comedy with Spirit Walker, plus I want to do it in first person so I can try to not have 1,000 characters like in Crown of Stars. So I keep kind of moving along to try to do something new rather than repeating. So that's to me what I'm passionate about with writing, is to seeing what new thing I can do.
When you write multi-book series, like many of us do, the fact is by the time you've finished a story, it's often been several years that you've been working on that story. So there's a powerful urge to do something different.
Oh, really powerful. Yeah.
Well, from a standpoint I'm in a unique position because I do these podcasts and I get to talk to all of you guys all the time. I'm also trying to get published. And I go and I talk to a lot of authors and editors and publishers at different conventions. I've gone to Pikes Peak Writers. And I had a conversation not too long ago with an editor who said, basically, if I love your book, it's still not my decision to publish it. I have to get buy-in from the marketing department and from this person and from this person in order to get it published. So there's a lot of pressure on the new author trying to come into the publishing scene, because we get hit with, well, what we're really looking for is this, or what we're really looking for is this, which is just kind of a rehashing of something that somebody else has already done. So it's kind of hard for the new author to do something unique.
Well, I'm not sure, just the new author. This is the same pressure that somebody who's been under contract for, 10 years at the same publisher gets too with each new manuscript submitted. It's a common problem all across the board. And it's also why, a lot of my friends who have years of experience in publishing are self-publishing now, because it's just, they're tired of dealing with that.
Okay. I mean,
Tad and I are very fortunate. We're at Daw Books, which doesn't operate that way. It's privately owned by Betsy Wolheim and Sheila Gilbert. They make all their own decisions.
Yeah,
that's
a family company.
It's very unusual now. Most writers I know are dealing with that whole, there's this huge hierarchy of people who aren't even reading the manuscript who have a say in whether or not it gets bought. And
not to mention that you oftentimes are also getting new editors every other book or so as well.
Yes.
And, you know, so that's another advantage those of us with a more settled publisher have.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So, and here's a question for you guys then. We've mentioned the big 5, 6, 3, whatever number they are currently at, and self-publishing, but I think that one of the places where science fiction and fantasy really benefits from kind of the smaller size of the genre is in the houses like Angry Robot, Daw, the ones that aren't the big multinational conglomerates, but that have, you know, a solid team in place, that have a wide series of books. I'm going to bring up a sore point for some people, but before Nightshade's implosion, they were bringing in some fantastic new authors. And so what is the position of kind of the mid-level house in maybe being what really pushes the boundaries and gets some of those newer trends out in front of readers that kind of ripples out into the rest of the industry?
And let's start with Laura on that question.
I think that's definitely a big advantage of the science fiction fantasy genre, having come from the romance genre originally, where there really hasn't been much of that effect. There's some of it, but it's much more prevalent in science fiction and fantasy. And I think it may be because there's just not as much money. In romance, you're really looking at appealing to a huge audience at the opportunity for every writer to make a lot of money. There's just a lot more commercial pressure. I think there are still these small and mid-sized pressure operations in science fiction and fantasy. They get in it because they really want to find that writer with the unique voice, the new kind of book. If they can make enough money to keep going, they're happy with that. And I think that somebody who immediately comes to mind who kind of came out of that sort of publishing house is Catherine Valenti, who I think is one of the most original writers in the genre. I find her voice very original, the type of story she tells very unusual, and she's just one example among many. I've given some cover quotes for Angry Robot books, and they, you know, have also done a lot of incredibly cool stuff. So I think, you know, I hope that movement remains really healthy in the genre, because I think it's been great for the variety and quality that we see.
Felix?
I don't know the answer to that question.
That's okay.
I don't know much about publishing houses.
Okay. Sarah, did you unmute your mic? There you
is
go.
Is it working?
Yes, it's
you're
working.
You're fine.
Yay. Okay, so I was kind of trying to fix my mic. What was the question?
publishing houses, mid you know, level publishing houses that are more established, that are pushing out really good stuff, like Nightshade before they imploded, and Angry Robot, and so on and so forth.
Prime.
But,
yes.
Pure.
Let's see. Well, I don't know.
Okay.
There's a lot of them. I get books from so many places that I just don't even pay attention anymore. Where they're coming from.
Do you get the feeling, Sarah, that it's adding to diversity in the field?
Yeah. Yeah, there's more publishers that are popping up that are willing to publish different thing. I'll see books on NetGalley now that'll be science fiction and fantasy with the subheading of gay. And so there, I never would have seen that a few years ago. So there's definitely more diversity. There are more publishers that are willing to focus on different quality of books. And you get these smaller publishing houses like Ragnarok, for example, who's willing to publish grim stuff, dark urban fantasy and fantasy, but it's just darker, a different type of fantasy than I'd find somewhere like Tor. So I think, with my two cents, that the internet kind of evens the playing field a lot. You can get a lot more people with self-publishing who are willing to publish just about anything, and they can. And then you get, you know, smaller publishing companies popping up all the time that are willing to focus on things like gay science fiction and fantasy that you just wouldn't have had a few years ago.
Well, changes in technology and distribution has made a huge difference here too, because it's much more fiscally viable now for a small company like, I'm going to say it wrong,
Ragnarok.
That it, yes. And Angry Robot and these other smaller companies, you know, ebooks are so much more affordable to produce and distribute.
According to all the publishers I talk to.
Well, that's true. But, you know, if you're actually speaking truth, man, it's a lot more affordable for them than the very massive, expensive, complex paper distribution system. And things like Kickstarter and crowdfunding and the more affordable digital production of audio now, all of these things give these small companies a lot of opportunities that were, you know, where it was incredibly expensive for them to get into publishing 15 or 10 years ago.
And speaking of diversity and publishing and the internet and all that, just for something that no one will care about, I got an email 2 days ago from a small press based out of India whose entire goal is to publish Indian science fiction and fantasy authors. I've been reviewing for 4.5 years, and it's the first time anything like that's ever happened. So I think the internet is definitely evening out the playing field and affecting diversity and all that in the genre. So
awesome.
I don't clue if I answered anything.
And there's so many books out there. Tad can't even stop writing his right now while he's on the podcast.
Actually, I was dropping Felix a message to say that we should swap Michael Moorcock stories sometimes because Michael's always been a huge influence on me too. So
very cool. Well, Kate, did you have anything you wanted to add to this?
I did actually. I think small presses have been important in the science fiction fantasy field for a long time because there's always been this niche market of people who want to read short story collections, anthologies that maybe are not reaching outside the core SNF field, but which can make enough sales that these small presses can at least, you know, break even or even make a small living. I mean, you see like Tachyon, Subterranean, Prime. I'm missing ones which I apologize for. And the other thing with the rise of ebooks is I'm just seeing this explosion of short fiction, and in particular with the novella, which, as someone once said, the novella is the, you know, perfect form for science fiction. I don't know whether I agree with that or not, but these things are now feasible, whether in print versions or whether in ebook versions, and self-publishing certainly creates a lot of novellas. And so I think the whole field, as Laura said before, where books get slotted and whether or not you have to write a 250,000 word or a 80,000 word is just, it's all changed up now and there's so much more opportunity. But again, a lot of it is very niche. It's very targeted and not necessarily to a huge audience, which seems to be the commercial publishers and certain self-publishing authors tend to be reaching that biggest audience.
It's interesting because commercial publishing has kind of more and more for a long time there was becoming more and more like something like the film business, where it was about, you know, going for the big grand slam, you know, going for the big hit. Whereas I think the actual future of books is probably a lot closer to something like the record business, where you see now we're moving towards a thing where, you know, the a lot of musicians are making a living, but they don't expect to make that living off of so much what they sell. In their case, it's things like touring. I don't think we writers quite have that, but I think that we're going to be kind of aiming for a smaller, more you know, more personal kind of connection with audiences and trying to really create a you know, an audience that comes back and stays in touch. So I think there's a lot of stuff changing right now.
You know,
social media has really pushed that along too. I interact with people in a much different way than I did 10 years ago.
You interact with me.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, yeah.
So
the marketing side of me is sitting here trying really, really hard to not pipe in, but I'm failing my control role here.
But hold on. But now hold on. Now Tad did mention the touring part would be difficult for authors. I do remember Harlan Ellison used to tour, and he would go to bookstores and he would take his typewriter, and people would pay, and they would throw out story ideas, and he would write short stories right there in front of them.
I'm not talking about that part of touring, Patrick. I'm talking about the fact that, although if anybody would be willing to try that, I would. But I'm talking about more the fact that rock musicians or musicians these days in general, a lot of them, from what I gather, are not counting so much on making their living off of just sales of records anymore. And what it's about is developing an audience that will come to see them play and pay money for that. And as far as I know, even with all the delightful writers we have on this particular podcast, I don't know if any of us yet is going to make a living off of people paying money to watch us talk about our fiction.
Well,
so that's
and just so you understand, musicians don't make any money off touring. I mean, they basically cram $5,000 worth of musical equipment into their $500 van that they bought off the guy. They drive, 1,000 miles paying the gas for a $200 gig. They're not making any money.
Well, no, I'm talking about, people like Elvis Costello and folks like that, who I hope is getting more than $200 a gig. I hope.
So we've been going for an hour and 20 minutes now, Jane. We need to wrap this up probably.
Right. So let's end with something fun then. Which of your books or series would you most like, or even short stories, would you most like to see translated to a visual medium? And who are the ideal actors that you would cast for, 2 to 3 of the main roles?
Felix.
I would like to see The Revolutions made into something. And I would like to have absolutely no involvement in the making of it. or any responsibility for it. And if it turns out terrible, I would like to blame other people. So, I don't know.
It sounds like you're preparing to cut ties already, and you haven't even made the deal
absolutely. I'm completely disowning this hypothetical thing.
He's going Alan Moore before anybody's even asked. I like that.
Very cool. Well, I hear Kevin Smith's interested, so nothing bad will happen there. Hey, Kate, what about you?
Oh, I'm going to have to let Tumblr, my fabulous fans on Tumblr, have the final say in this one. I would say the Spirit Walker trilogy, and they've already cast it. There would be Jessica Sula as the main character, Kat, Kiki Palmer, or the one who was in Misfits, whose name I'm blanking on, Ruth Negga. As B, really like Aldous Hodge as Andavi, although that would work. He's great. And a Brazilian model as Rory, but I can't remember his name. So that's where you have it.
Okay. Tad?
Well, personally, if I had a choice, I would probably like to see the Otherland books made, because I think they're kind of the most unusual compared to a lot of all the other epic fantasy stuff that people are doing. And if that was the case, all I really need is Lupita Nyong'o, who would be brilliant as the main one of the main characters.
Yes, Rini. She'd be perfect.
We just actually had a discussion on Facebook the other night. I was so embarrassed because we were talking about the Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn books. And we basically decided that virtually every male part and several female parts should be played by Tom Hiddleston. that's basically it. We just decided we'll just get Tom and he'll play everything. So that's my input.
Laura?
Definitely would be my Esther Diamond series. It's contemporary urban fantasy comedy set in New York. Esther's always in a show in different kinds of costumes. She has friends who are drag queens. It would really lend itself to that kind of thing. I'd also like to, make a deal for that, because I'm on book 7 right now and have many more planned. So I could make so much money if somebody would start filming the books.
Yeah, but you say that and then you go and you look at the Dresden Files TV show. So,
This is in the perfect world we're talking about, right? Because it's not like I even have an offer. This is all hypothetical. Let me enjoy my fantasy.
Okay. So yeah, in the fantasy, I'm just guessing that Dick Wolf is not the person on the other end of the phone calling you.
Well, it's funny because there's a TV series within the Esther Diamond series that's based on the whole Law and Order thing. Esther plays a homeless, junkie, bisexual prostitute suspected of killing her pimp.
Well, Dick Wolf was the executive producer, if I'm not mistaken, on the Dresden Files TV series. Sarah.
Yeah, he doesn't really have a light touch. That wouldn't have worked.
No, Sarah. What
Someone named Dick Wolf doesn't have a light touch? The joke's right to himself.
Sarah, I'm putting you on the spot.
This is a family podcast. Stop that.
What do you want to see as a TV show or a movie or something?
Okay.
And how would you like to see your best reviews cast when they make it?
Oh, yeah.
Who'd play you, Sarah?
Oh, God, help everyone. So I'm not a published author. I'm not cool like the rest of you guys. But one of the authors that I think would be really cool to see on TV would be C.S. Friedman's books, because I love her anti-heroes. And I think they would translate interesting to TV. As for actors, I don't even know who's acting now. So fill in the blank. But there you go.
I read some of the C.S. Friedman books. Which ones did I read?
I don't know, but In Conquest Born might be a really nice miniseries. That's the one with the female and the male antagonists.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good one.
The Cold Fire trilogy is the one I read, Sarah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like her stuff a lot.
I wouldn't mind seeing like some of J.V. Jones' stuff, I think would translate well.
Yeah.
See, I like I'm going to tell all of you right now who are out there writing. I like it when people actually eat and drink and sleep in the books, because it just feels more. It's like I put characters eating in a science fiction novel and my critique group shit themselves.
If you like people eating in their books, you must read Stephen Bruce, don't you?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. Not only would he be somebody who I'd throw out, as you could do some really cool TV and film stuff with his work, but, I mean, he's very funny. But, oh, my God, the food stuff just runs all through it. It's a huge, huge issue. His character's always stopping to make complicated omelets in the middle of deadly peril. So
my critique group actually did say, were you hungry when you wrote this?
Yeah.
Anyway, Jame, anything else before we get to final thoughts?
Nope, I think final thoughts is good.
Okay, so final thoughts. This is your chance to say whatever you want on this subject or anything else and tell people your website again and all that good stuff. Let's start with you, Laura.
My website, lauraresnick.com. I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm on this podcast. All I really look for as a reader and a writer is a good story well told.
Very good. Kate?
Website is KateElliott, 2Ls, 2Ts.com. I'm also on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr. And I love long, complicated worlds populated with fascinating emotional characters. I like immersive stories, as Tad says.
Very cool. Felix?
I'm on Twitter under my name. I'm not on Facebook or Tumblr or anything else.
You are on Facebook, actually, but...
Well, I'm technically on Facebook, but I don't remember the password.
I was going to say, obviously, you don't spend a lot of time there.
Yeah. But yes, technically, I have a Facebook page. I don't think I have any last thoughts.
Okay. Tad?
Basically TadWilliams, .com is the clever title of my website, Facebook, Twitter, and various, incarnations. And, other than that, I just want my dad to quit hitting my mom.
Oh,
Tad.
Okay, well, I was going to say what the truth is. The truth is actually very uninteresting. I've been sitting here, except for that time when I was interrupting Kate's conversation by typing, I've actually been watching our four wild rabbits outside my window the whole time. So, you know, but I couldn't figure out how to work that into a wrap-up, so I thought I'd go for pathos.
Gotcha. Well, then I'll just say that as soon as this finishes, I have to go and jump in an outrigger canoe and go paddling on the ocean.
Aloha.
Thank you.
Oh, you have a hard life.
I was going to say, there's no pathos in that at all. Not bit one.
Well, there is a hurricane coming. I don't know.
Okay.
Please don't. I have to stay up all night working on an overdue book. I think I win for Pathos.
You win. You win.
I didn't know it was a contest, but you know, if, next time I'll actually come up with something real, and then we'll find out who is the most pathetic.
Sarah, do you want to clobber them all?
I have to wake up at 4 a.m. so I can go count money. So I don't know if that compares with anything, but
Whose money, Sarah?
Not mine, unfortunately. Okay, it would be nice if it was mine, but...
Then it counts as pathos.
Yeah. So, final thoughts? I don't really have any. This is just, but thanks for inviting me on. This has been completely surreal and cool because everybody here has been one of the authors that I never, ever thought I'd talk to. So,
hey, Sarah.
Yes.
What's that project that we've been talking about that you're going to be doing?
Oh, God.
Not that I'm going to put you on the spot here at all.
So I've been asked by a lot of people to maybe think about putting together a Special Needs and Strange Worlds anthology, compiling some of the most popular essays and posts, whatever you want to call them, that people have written in so far, and I'm thinking about doing it, but I'm kind of terrified, so I keep putting it off.
I'll buy it.
There you go.
I think you absolutely should. You should absolutely do it.
You want a blurb?
No, but if you want to write for me, Tad, I would love it. I would fly to your house in California, and
no,
I would
wait.
Bring
I said
cookies.
I'm not sure I want to take on writing somebody else's book, but I mean, that's why I said blurb. It's shorter.
It's just you write one post is what she's talking about.
Yeah. Keep in mind that Tad hates writing.
Yes,
I will. That's true. I hate it. Tell you what, actually, it'll be even better if you will fly me to Kate's house. So I'll write anything. Sorry, I keep saying that thing. I will write whatever. I'll even write a big, thick, unwanted, giant tome for you.
There you go.
Well,
who could refuse that offer?
They do have an interstate, so we can just rent you a car.
Yeah, with window seals that are very tight.
Exactly. We'll get you the James Bond car. James, final thoughts.
Just that I think that anyone who likes fantasy, this is a great, great time for you to be a fan. There are so many wonderful books that have already been written, you know, over the last 100 or so years. There are so many books that are coming out, you know, just right now. And we're starting to see coming up through the short story market and the debut novelists. We are seeing some absolutely amazing stories that we've never seen before. So it's a really great time to kind of reach outside of your comfort zone. Google who some new fantasy authors are, check out some of the short story markets, and just find yourself, you know, some new favorites to love and recommend.
Very cool. And as always, I am a huge fan of fantasy, so everybody should go out there and read more fantasy because it's just wonderful stuff.
Yes.
I want to thank our bagel overlord once again for letting us have this podcast on sfsignal.com. My name is Patrick Custer. I'm ATFMB everywhere. Thanks to everyone for coming on tonight, and go read a book.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Magic wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.